Barely Research Facts is a fact-based podcast brought to you by Art Now Das, an experiential arts agency based out of Mumbai. Each week, we pick a word at random, dive into it, and see what it brings to us. We are your hosts. My name is Ragini, and this is Shar. Let's go.
Hi, and welcome back to Barely Research Facts. This is our 12th episode, Ragini.
Oh my God. Oh my God, my God. Yeah, that does feel a bit overwhelming, doesn't it?
It does a little bit. Can't believe we've got through 12. Well, 11.
I know.
Clearly not, still not great at numbers. So if you have been listening to any of our 11 other episodes, do give us a like or a review and share it. Share it with your friends, bro. Come on, do us a solid.
Yeah, and subscribe. Subscribe. Yeah. People have told us to tell people to do that.
Yes, apparently it's important.
It's a thing. Just do it, guys.
So the word for this episode is palm. And yeah. Ragini, tell us why it's an oldie but a goodie.
We had test run at our early days as one of our pilot episodes before we even knew BRF would actually be a thing.
Yeah, we inflicted it upon our friends and family.
Yeah, and said, please listen, tell us what you think. Yeah. And maybe someday when we feel very, very brave, I think about 10 years from now, we might put up some those pilot episodes and let everyone have a...
Yeah, it'll show people really how far we've come.
We've really come a long way, trust
us. Not very.
But from doing things like, you know, having a really lovely, very melodious, but consistent track across the entire podcast, to then realize...
We had a backing track.
Yeah, to the whole thing.
Which was unanimously hated by all.
Yeah, we got some very strong feedback about that, including, oh my God, it's so annoying, delete it now.
Yes. So palmistry, go into a little bit of the history of palmistry, because why not? The history of palm reading, uncertain. The roots are uncertain, but...
Oh,
and that's
wow.
The end of that.
That's
next.
A short segment.
So the history of palm reading, it's uncertain where it originated from, but it could have come from India because it has a strong basis in Hindu astrology. So another feather in our Indian cap.
Yeah.
I like how we're basking like in the reflected limelight of eons of knowledge.
I mean, our biggest success at this point is we're 12 episodes into a podcast. So
yep,
I think we can be forgiven.
Yeah, okay. From its roots in India, it spread to China, Tibet, Persia, Egypt, and ancient Greece. And this could have possibly been through the traditional fortune-telling of the Roma, because their original home was the north of the Indian subcontinent. The chiromantic art, which is also something that it's called, chiromancy or chirosophy. Mm. Forgive me for the pronunciation of these. So it's essentially the reading of character and divination of the future by interpretation of lines and undulations on the palm of the hand.
Ooh.
Which I think Ragini can attest that mine has a lot of both lines and undulations.
And as we move on in this episode, I do a small segment where I read Shar's palm, because I have now read a total of 2 articles on the internet about palm reading, and I am the resident expert.
Yep. Well, yeah. You know, we've all got to have our things. Also, word to the wise, don't take HD pictures of your hand. It will terrify you. So from the ancient art of fortune telling, palmistry went through, you know, significant as the years progressed. Medieval palmistry was pressed into service by witch hunters.
Wow.
Which is interesting because their interpretation was from pigmentation spots, and they saw this as a sign of a pact with the devil.
Oh. That if you had pigments on your palm, you had a pact with the devil.
Yeah, if you happen to have freckles or...
Ouch, I do.
Or a mole in an unfortunate place, sorry.
Unfortunate place being your palm, basically.
Yeah. After a period of disrepute...
Clearly, I don't know this very well. Like, very quick shift.
After a period of disrepute, palmistry flourished again in the Renaissance. In the 17th century, attempts were made to develop empirical and rational foundations for its basic principles. So they gave it a good go to make it a science. And then came the period of enlightenment, and obviously popularity took a downturn. But then it came back in the 19th century with the work of people such as Casimir da Pentini. Sorry for murdering your last name, Casimir. Louis Hamon, who is also known as Count Louis Hamon. And I think Ragini has a little bit of information later on in the episode about this interesting gentleman.
I do.
And William Benham. So in the 20th century, in the late 19th and early 20th, I'd say, palmistry enjoyed quite a revival in the West, along with other divinatory arts. So, you know, there was like, they'd have seances and they'd have, you know, communing with ghosts and all this other stuff, which took advantage of people who were grieving, but it was quite interesting how obsessed with it people became. In fact, in 1889, the English Chirological Society was founded with the purpose of making the study of the hand a scientific pursuit.
Oh, did they get very far with that?
I'd say about as far as we are now, like, or ever were in the past. Also, interestingly, I didn't know that there was a connection, but in the 20th century, early to mid 20th century, palmistry received renewed attention and interpretation among followers of Carl Jung, which I thought was, very strange.
Strange.
So although there isn't any scientific support for the contention that physical features observed in palmistry have any kind of psychic or occult predictive meaning, meaning that, you know, hand no tell future, the human hand does show evidence of other things such as a person's health, cleanliness, occupational, you know, proclivities, nervous habits, things like that. So you could possibly make interesting assumptions or logical conclusions.
Did you also know, by the way, that Alexander the Great used to take a great interest in examining the character of his officers by analyzing the lines on their hands?
So he used to read their palms?
He used to read their palms and tell their future, which I think is slightly unfair HR practices, if you ask me. I mean, that, like, very seriously, because I do feel like if your manager is in charge of your professional future by default, is then going to read your palm to tell you what your professional future should be.
I like how you took the most modern example to, like, Alexander the Great, who was basically just a despot, not a despot, but, you know, was in charge. He could have just been like, off with your head, and it would have been off without question. He wouldn't have had to fill in a 9-page report. Right? He would not have had to do that.
And read their palm.
Yeah.
Early HR practices by Alexander. All right. So coming from, I'm taking a huge jump in history from Alexander to Kero, who is also known as Count, come on, please give me his first name.
Louis.
Also known as Count Louis Hamon. Count Louis Hamon was born as William John Warner and in time grew to be popularly known as Kero because of just how proficient he was in the skill of palm reading and rather how famous he got actually in that. He was an Irish astrologer and a very colorful occult figure. And he lived from about 1866 to about 1936 actually, to be precise. He's a self-described clairvoyant who learned palmistry, astrology, and numerology in India. And he came down to India, stayed here for about 2 years, studied this in depth with a guru that whom he met here. Throughout his life, he was quite certain that he was not going to marry. Like, he was not inclined to marry, but he did know that he was going to end up being married, which did happen apparently later, very late in life, when he felt very sick and a woman took care of him and then he married her. So I don't know how seriously I take that, though, because I'm just like, if my job was to tell people's future and then if I make an assumption on my future, I guess I would just do what it took to go through with that.
Yeah.
Just to prove myself right.
Yeah.
Because
I'd predict I'd have extremely short hair in 2025 and then just chop my hair.
Doesn't matter what's going on. You go and you get a haircut no matter what.
I'll get married in 2028 and then ignore every other person until then and just get married.
And then just meet someone in 2028 and just be like, yeah, you.
You are the one.
You must. He did, however, come back from India to Europe, and it was during his time in Europe that he kind of developed this, like, really wide following of some extremely famous clients. And this is kind of what catapulted him into this sort of, you know, demigod clairvoyant status, I guess.
Wow.
But he told the fortunes of famous celebrities like Mark Twain, Martha Hari, Oscar Wilde, Thomas Edison, Edward VIII, who is the uncle to Queen Elizabeth and is the king who abdicated his throne.
As the Crown has very... very nicely told me.
We know all of this now because of the Crown. I know great amounts of British monarchy history.
Yeah. Which at the end of the day is like Such inconsequential knowledge. It's just entertaining, isn't it?
But I just used it in this podcast. So it's multipurpose.
Yeah, you're right. I stand corrected. Continue. Yeah.
So he would document his sittings with these clients by asking them to sign a guest book in which they would sort of recount how they felt as, you know, subjects of these experiences. Edward VIII, he wrote that I would not be surprised if he did not give up everything, including his right to be crowned for the woman he loved.
Mm.
And of course, he went on to abdicate his throne because he fell in love with a divorced woman who was not accepted by the court at the time. Mm. And, you know, he predicted that the Jews would return to Palestine and the country would once again be called Israel. This was before 1936, mind you. There is a book called Titanic's Last Secrets, which includes a detailed account of one of Cairo's palm readings with William Pirer, who is the chairman of Harland and Wolff, builders of the Titanic. He predicted that he would soon be in a fight for his life, and where he's talking about the battle surrounding the sinking of the Titanic.
Ooh,
so
that's a bit scary. Yeah,
so it's also... It is, but it's also, you know, he's obviously seems to have a penchant for being very accurate with his palm readings. And he was also, you know, someone who was supposed to have predicted world events. But I think that's kind of contentious because as he grew in his status as a society palmist, you know, once you start getting clients of a certain stature in society who have an impact on world events as a consequence of their own status, I don't know how much, you know, he's actually predicting world events versus he's actually predicting the future of the people who are coming to meet him. And they just happen to be well-known enough to actually be consequential to current world events at the time. So basically, in time, Cairo moved to London, at which point he had many people who were also skeptics who would come in and have their palms read by him, and whom at times he was also able to convert. Mark Twain was one of them who was a convert. Not entirely, but he was extremely impressed with the accuracy by which Cairo had read his palm. From London, towards the end of his life, he moved to America and he spent his final years as doing some, I mean, with a few clients, but also doing some screenwriting, which I think is a slightly odd career direction for him. In 1936, he died following a heart attack, and it was a heart attack that he had predicted almost to the minute, according to his wife. So he did predict his own death as well. And that is the story of Cairo, who was one of the most prominent palm readers of our time.
Interesting man. Really interesting.
Going from one famous palm reader to me.
Oh, you. Okay.
Reading Shara's palm.
Oh, God. All right.
So for the purposes of this, Shara sent me pictures of her palm. All right. So now I'm going to try, okay?
Oh, God. Don't tell me if I'm going to die in the near future. I don't want to know that.
Okay.
Don't say okay, like that's what it was.
I don't know what the lifeline is what I realized actually as you said that.
So we're off to a great start.
Great start. Okay. So basically, there are four kinds of palms: earth, fire, air, and water. And each palm is categorized as such based on its physical appearance. And Shara's palm appears to be a fire hand.
Yes.
Which is basically, you have a long palm and short fingers. No, actually, sorry. You have water hand. No, you have a small palm. Okay, this is really bad. You have a small palm and small fingers. You have earth hands, I think. Do you have short fingers or long fingers?
I've been told I have long fingers, but I know that I have huge hands. Like, I have to hide them in photographs. Because they're so big.
Take over your face.
Yeah. Everything really in the picture.
Okay, I'm going to go with air hands. I think you have air hands, which is a square palm and long finger.
Yeah, I think that's more likely.
Yeah? Okay. So,
I like these crowdsourced answers. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I think that's the correct one.
And this type of hand basically typically signifies intellectually curious individuals.
Yeah.
Good for you, sir.
I like that.
With innate analytical abilities and communication skills. That's you. Well
done. That sounds like a super amazing version of me.
People with air hands are usually very easily distracted and if not stimulated can become anxious or edgy.
My God, this is describing me to a T.
Yeah.
Okay, don't agree.
Now, there are a bunch of other things which are some mounts that you can see. which I don't understand very much of, but I have figured out which the lifeline, what the lifeline is, and it looks like you have a very nice long life. Well done.
Great. That's good.
You have a very short wisdom line, though, I must say.
What does that mean? You just told me I was intellectually curious.
Yeah, but for a short period of time, clearly. I think what your hand is saying is that you might not be... I think it's called... Your hand is calling you stupid, Charles.
Oh, I think it's you, Ragini, calling me stupid. So... Thank you. I'm not going to take anything you say as Bible.
Yeah, there are a bunch of other lines, but I can't figure them out really. So I think we'll just leave it at that.
Yay!
There
good
is
job.
Intellectual curiosity for short periods of time and a very long life.
Okay, great. A life well
summed.
So in
the course of a long life, you will have many, 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 many thoughts.
Of some intellect.
Yay! If any of you would like your palms read by me,
don't.
Please do send us pictures of your hands and don't.
No, but do send us your hands in and we'll pick a few and put it up on our Instagram in the stories. So, you know, it's not there forever. Okay, oh, so
look at you, little social media novice.
So going from palms and reading them, let me talk a little bit about the murderer's thumb. Have you heard about this?
Ooh, no.
So I'll tell it from the perspective of this lady who came across it. I will also put the link to the article in the blog post for those interested. So her teenage daughter comes to her and says that she has a malformation of her hands and that it's called murderer's thumb. Basically, what it means is that her thumbs were small and stubby, with shortened nails. And you'd think that this was just like a normal feature. But apparently this is a thing. Some people do have it. And it's very clearly apparent when you do have it. It's also called shovel thumb, toe thumb, Dutch thumb, hammer thumb, stub thumb, and potter's thumb.
Wow.
But the medical name for it is brachydactyly, type D.
Oh, lame.
Yeah. So apparently it's not terribly rare. It appears in about 0.4% of the population in the US. Don't have any figures for India or the UK, I'm sorry to say. It's an inherited trait and it's mostly found in women rather than men. It's completely harmless and even provides unexpected benefits in keyboard typing, which I did think, you know, like you wouldn't have as much of a difficult time with shorter thumbs on a keyboard. Now, in terms of palmistry, going back a little bit into palmistry, practitioners of palmistry took up the cause against BDD with great enthusiasm. Palm readers brought the term murderer's thumb into the mainstream. The palmist Cairo, who we've heard a lot about by now, he writes of people with murderer's thumbs and says, if they're opposed, they fly into ungovernable passions and blind rages. They have no control over themselves and are liable to go to any extreme of violence or crime during one of their tempers.
That was interesting. Did not come across that in my palmistry research, I must say. And I did extensive work. All right. I'm going to really move on from palmistry now because I feel like we spent a lot of time on it. Interesting stuff, though. But I'm actually going to come to some idioms around palms and how those come from. So, I mean, idioms and just superstitions to do with palms and stuff like that. But you know how there is a popular superstition that that basically says that if your palm is itching you, and I don't know which palm, I think it's your right palm or your left palm, some palm has to itch you. But apparently if that happens, money is coming your way and, you know, you're going to get rich. Apparently this possibly comes from an old belief. The explanation could actually be really simple. And it could just be what you said, right? It could just be an allergy. So... It's possible that back in the day when people had an allergy of some sort or there was, you know, there was something, there was a rash of some sort on your palm or anywhere else, just rubbing a bit of silver on it would sort of provide relief. And so, right, and so it wasn't just silver. Sometimes it was also about like just rubbing some wood and then maybe wood just became to like, you know, kind of rubbing some kind of metal and then metal just became silver because I guess it was less, it wouldn't rust. And, you know, so you'd have a relatively purer metal that you were rubbing on inflamed skin. That's where the belief originates from.
Did you used to do this, Ragini, when you were bitten by a wasp or, you know, a bee, then you'd be asked to rub iron or metal on it. So I just looked it up, and apparently people rub their hand against metal when a honeybee stings because bee venom, I don't know about wasp venom, but bee venom is acidic in nature, and metals react with acid released by bee stings and thus neutralize its effect.
Hmm. Oh, well, so much stuff we just do just because people tell us to do.
Pass down. Some of it utter rubbish though, huh? So the phrase that came to mind to me related to palms was to grease someone's palm. And if you don't know what that means, it's to bribe someone.
Yes.
Apparently, the phrase comes from the practice of applying grease to a machine to make it run smoothly, which is not the furthest jump that I could have imagined. The same expression exists in French as something that I'm not going to pronounce. Not going to attempt to, but it exists in French. Suffice to say, it exists.
I fully empathize.
Now, the form with palm is now predominant, but hand also appears in the earliest recorded versions dating back to the 16th century. So as long as machines have been around, it's always been used as a lubricant of some sort to make something work better. So that's the origin of the phrase, to grease someone's palm.
Oh, interesting. Did not know that. Okay, a third interesting phrase with the word palm is also actually related to bribing someone, or rather paying someone for their service, potentially. It's crossing your palm with silver. And so this is basically used usually, could potentially mean to bribe somebody. It could also mean to just pay for a service. It could particularly pay in advance for a service. So the phrase actually alludes to an old practice of placing silver coins across a fortune teller's hand before having their fortune told. So you first cross a fortune teller's hand with silver, and then they, you know, and then they would tell you what you need to know. And so now it's usually used
as opposed to the usual sleazy way of doing it. This is like a
fun way to ask for a bribe.
Fun way.
Or
five tips on how to ask for a bribe cutely.
Or the books are very serious way. Make it impossible for them to say no. Yeah, and so, or it's just, you know, it's a way to just ask for a tip. That's how the phrase originates.
So those were the three most interesting idioms that we came up with that were related to palm. But now, moving on from the bodily feature, the palm, let's move on from it, shall we?
Okay. Yeah, I think it's about time.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about palm leaves. The palm branch, it's a symbol of victory, triumph, peace, and eternal life. And all these are mostly concepts that are still upheld in the Middle East and the Mediterranean worlds. Historically, they've, you know, given a lot of importance to the palm branch. A palm branch was awarded to victorious athletes in ancient Greece, and a palm frond, or the tree itself, is one of the most common attributes of victory personified in ancient Rome. The Assyrians believed that the ultimate symbol of eternal life was a tree growing beside a stream, which is a very generalized description, but the tree that they valued the most was the palm tree. I think this is familiar to most Christians and most people really everywhere. On Palm Sunday, which is a week before Easter, Christians often carry palm fronds as part of a symbolic ritual that commemorates Jesus Christ's triumphal entry into Jerusalem, as foretold by a prophet. According to the Bible, people cut branches from palm trees, laid them across Jesus's path, and then waved them in the air in a form of welcome. Going across to a different part of the world, in Greece, an abundance of historical testimonies have survived, such as the myth of the birth of Apollo between a palm tree and an olive tree on the island of Delos. This event led to the palm tree also being known as the tree of birth. And then several millennia later, palm and olive trees continue to be associated with other myths, or more accurately, perhaps versions of the original myths. The 1932 World Olympics in Los Angeles, it's believed by some historians to be the reason for palms being planted along streets and pretty much every public park and gathering place in the city. So, you know, Los Angeles and palm trees are synonymous. And this is probably where it started. It was part of the beautification project, and it gave jobs to more than 400 unemployed men during the Great Depression, which was huge. And approximately 40,000 Mexican fan palm trees were planted along 150 miles of city streets. And since then, wow, they've obviously become a very key sign of Hollywood.
Oh. So the last bit for this episode, this is a very... So most of us sometimes have situations where our hands get extremely sweaty. And then normally it's normally to do with high stress situations, you know. So if you're very nervous. And so basically, this is because there are sweat glands that are placed highly concentrated in within our hands, forehead and our feet. And that's why those are usually the first to start sort of sweating in a stressful situation. For some of us, it happens in just, you know, when we're in stressful situations that our palms really start sweating. For some people, apparently, it just happens all the time. I don't know. I mean, I just think that's really sad. But yeah, poor guys, man. But anyway, apparently, they just have like sweaty palms all the time. And for that purpose, I came across this amazing product on Kickstarter. So clearly, our research is like deep on this. But it's this really cool fan, this mouse, sorry, with a fan on the inside. And it has these little vents, like it has these little grooves in it. And when you put your palm on it, as you're gaming or using your mouse or whatever, it basically, these fans are kind of like cooling your palm down. It was an incredibly thoughtful and interesting product. But I shall send you the link. You have to check it out. But I don't know how it's going to smell after months of use because, you know, sweaty palms on it. However, I will re-end this episode by reading out a review for this product, which is super fun. The author writes, I'm curious about how the fan will respond after months of eccrine gland secretions have been dripped onto it. But hey, that's a mental picture you won't be able to unsmell. I completely agree with that. Beyond that, it looks like a mouse. It rolls like a mouse. The scroll wheel is nice and it's a mouse. And to end with one final quote from the wife of the author, what a fun mouse. Which is where I am sold, honestly. That for that one line is why I would buy this mouse. Sounds like
just
fun.
Just what a fun mouse. I'm just going to try and sell you other things like, oh, what a fun bank transfer into Shah's account.
That's the episode for Palm. Thank you very much for tuning in and listening to us all over again. We will see you in 2 weeks with our 13th episode. Until then, listen to the episode, tell your friends to listen to the episode, and we will see you next time.
Okay, that's it for today. The episode you just heard was edited by Mohit Chandilya. Music for the episode is by Charitha Arora. If you'd like to reach out to us about the podcast, the episode, or you just want to say hi in general, we're on Instagram as Barely Research Facts. You could also come to the website at www.artnowdas.in. If you like the podcast, review, subscribe, and please share it with other podcast lovers in your circle. It would mean so much to us. Until next time, bye.